You're listening to Bombshell Radio. Be sure to subscribe on bombshellradio.com and stream or download your favorites. Get your fix. Bombshell Radio 24/7.
I'm Alex Green, and this is Stereo Embers, the podcast. Check this out.
In the morning when you rise, do you open up your eyes, see what I see? Do you see the same things every day? Of a way to start the day, getting things in proportion, spread the news and help the world go around. Have you heard of a time that will help us get it together again? Have you heard of the word that will stop us?
That is the music of Yes, featuring Tony Kaye, who is my guest today on the program. Now, Yes are in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They've sold millions of albums. They have legions of devoted fans, and they've been around for 50 years. So does Tony Kaye need an introduction? You're probably thinking no. Well, I'm thinking yes. So let me tell you a little bit about Tony Kaye. Born in Leicester in the mid-1940s, Tony Kaye's family was playing music long before he arrived. People say things like, oh, so-and-so was born into a musical family, but that usually means their dad had a dusty guitar in his real estate office, or, I don't know, their mom sang in a choir in college before becoming an optometrist. But in the case of Tony Kaye, he really did come from a musical family. In fact, you could say music was hardwired into his DNA. His grandmother was a concert pianist. His grandfather was a jazz saxophonist. And his dad? Well, his dad kept a dusty guitar in his real estate office. I'm joking. At 4, Kaye began training in formal piano. By 8, he was playing notable classical pieces by heart. Just to give you a comparison here, at 4, I was eating bowls of Frosted Flakes using orange juice instead of milk. By 8, I was still doing that. But back to our story. There were no two ways about it. Tony Kaye was a prodigy. By 12, he was playing live, performing solo and duet classical pieces. The plan? Well, the plan was to study at the Royal College of Music in London and become a working concert pianist. But Kaye got thrown off of his straight-shot musical trajectory by, you guessed it, jazz. Inspired by everyone from Count Basie to Duke Ellington, by 15, Tony Kaye had founded a jazz trio, and not long after, he became a member of the Danny Rogers Orchestra. The combination of jazz, a lack of confidence, and, let's face it, maybe even some burnout, all added up to Kaye deciding not to go to the Royal College of Music in London, but instead enroll at Leicester Art College, where he studied advertising and design, and at night, well, at night, he played in bands. With the grand piano his grandmother had left him after her death, collecting dust back at home, by the 60s, Tony Kaye had all but abandoned his classical roots, and his love of jazz morphed into a love of pop music. A move to London and several nights out at the Marquee was all it took to spin Kaye around rather thoroughly. At that point, he was playing a transistor-based combo organ called a Vox Continental. That was a relatively new instrument that was introduced in 1962. So, the new instrument, the new city, and the new genre of music that had Kaye under its spell were all collectively blowing his mind. But keyboardist, occultist, and genuine madman genius Graham Bond is the guy that really knocked Kaye out. People who described what it was like to see Graham Bond play live sound the same as people who describe years later what it was like to see the Sex Pistols. One person I talked to who used to frequent the Marquee said this: Bond was a brilliant madman. He was ramshackle, and he was utterly genius. He was a combination of Mozart and a werewolf pounding away under a full moon during the apocalypse. Aside from Bond's undeniable charisma and captivating performances, what really made an impression on Kay was the fact that you didn't have to play a keyboard like a piano. You could do other stuff with it. And that's exactly what Kay decided to do. Using this new approach to his instrument, Kay spent the better part of the 60s packing his CV. He played in the covers and comedy outfit The Federals, then he was in Johnny Taylor's Star Combo, and then he was in Winston's Fums. He toured Europe with Johnny Halliday, and then he punched the clock for a bit with a band called Bittersweet. By this point, Kay had become a bit of a night owl and a road dog, two animal associations perfectly suited for a life in rock and roll. And that rock and roll life was about to really begin. Now, there was a London-based psych outfit called Mabel Greer's Toy Shop that, at the time, had generated a bit of a buzz thanks to a lot of shows all around London that ranged from universities to clubs like the Marquee and Electric Garden. Needless to say, Mabel Greer's Toy Shop had amassed quite a local following. John Peel even invited them onto his show to record a few numbers. At one point, Tony Kaye had met Mabel's singer John Anderson, and when Mabel's decided to form a new group, Kaye's name came up, and bass player Chris Squire invited him to try out. Then these things happened. Tony Kaye got the gig, the band became Yes, and in 3 years, they put out three records: 1969's self-titled effort, 1970's Time in a Word, and 1971's The Yes Album. Okay, so now we're in 1971, only 47 more years to go to bring you up to date about the story of Tony Kaye. Watch how fast I can make the years go. It's not going to be easy, but I am a trained professional. So here's the thing. Kay may have left his classic training behind, but in many ways he was still very much a purist. How much of a purist was he? Well, while on tour in the US to promote the Yes album, Kay said no to playing the synthesizer. And that got him fired. He was replaced by Rick Wakeman, and that was that. He played with the prog band Flash, then he formed Badger with David Foster, and then he moved to Los Angeles where, oddly enough, he lived next door to Led Zeppelin's John Bonham. I'm sure those two guys spent many quiet nights together playing chess and talking about Proust. Now look, I don't know the details of what was going on in Tony Kaye's life at that time, but if the stories are true, let's just say this. The road dog and the night owl had combined to become one hell of a party animal. But he was still packing his CV. He hung out with Bowie in Jamaica, and later he toured with him. His new band Detective that he formed with Michael DeBar actually opened up for Kiss, and then Tony Kaye joined Badfinger. He ended up coming back to Yes in 1982. He actually played on their massive comeback album 90125. And then, in 1994, look how fast I got us to 1994, he left Yes again. He played in a Neil Young tribute band, and he did some playing on some Pink Floyd tribute albums that were overseen by his buddy Billy Sherwood. But for the most part, he was kind of retired from the music business, and he was hanging out in Sherman Oaks and the Cayman Islands. He fell in love. He got married. He was playing some tennis. What do you want from the guy? It had been a long rock and roll life, and he wanted to just kind of chill. Who could blame him? And who could blame him for joining Yes again? He decided to join his bandmates for the Yes 50 Summer Tour, a tour which takes the band all the way through July on a fairly sprawling tour. Tony Kaye is back temporarily, but if you get a chance to see him, I would recommend that you do. I don't want to get into the factions of Yes, because there are two camps, or are there three? Well, there are several camps featuring several members and former members. And frankly, I don't get it. I don't understand it. It's confusing. There have been a lot of people that have gone in and out of Yes. Some of them are friends. Some of them aren't. There's some hostility and there's some love in all of those camps. But Yes 50 does one really great thing, and it brings a lot of people that have been in that band together again, and it's a pretty cool thing. So if you get a chance to see the Yes 50 tour this summer, I think that would be a good night out. How many bands can say they've been together in one form or another for 50 years? That's a rhetorical question, but I'll answer it anyway. Not that many. Tony Kaye is the distinguished gentleman of rock and roll. I think you're going to like this guy. He's very cool, and I enjoyed talking to him. So here's my chat with Tony Kaye of Yes. Enjoy it right here on Stereo Embers, the podcast. I know we're both tennis players, and I started playing tennis at the same age that you started playing piano. I think I was 5. And now at my age, my relationship to my racket is totally different. And I'm wondering, how is your relationship to your instrument? Has it changed over the years? Do you regard it in a different way?
That's an interesting question. I hadn't really thought of it in that way, except, you know, as we know on the tennis court, when you actually become one with the racket, then your performance as a tennis player just takes on a whole other aspect. It's pretty much that way, I think, with... I'm not sure that that's general. I mean, I've found in the past first kind of... felt that feeling when I was a classical player, you know, back in when I was, you know, learning to be a classical pianist, where you do have to become kind of one with the instrument. In rock and roll, maybe not as much, but certainly I get what you're getting at. It's an interesting question. And I think a certain amount of it with all of us, you know, even if you're a drummer, for instance, that maybe, you know, that applies too, maybe even more. And when I look at drummers play, I mean, they certainly look like they're with one with what they're doing, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, there are days where I'll play tennis and the racket feels like an extension of my hand, and there are other days where it feels like it's 300 pounds.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's the days when you feel completely with the game and with the court and the ball, and everything seems to flow. Well, they call it, you know, in tennis, they call it the zone. I mean, it's in the zone. And when you watch tennis players who are in the zone or actually not in the zone, it becomes obvious what, you know, not being in the zone is. And all tennis players have days like that. I think maybe Dimitrov had that problem today.
Yes, he did. Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, I saw a little bit of his interview. A shame, really, because actually he could be a great. You know, it's just so difficult for these new guys to. I mean, he's not so new, but you know what I mean. To actually take on the greatness, it's not guaranteed.
No, he has all of the attributes of future greatness, but for some strange reason, I guess, you know, sometimes it's all in your head. You know, your physical gifts may be there, but it's all about the mental aspect of it.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. You were mentioning in rock and roll, you were saying that rock and roll wasn't so much hinging on that kind of harmony, whereas classical was. What is the difference between the two? Why does one require that?
You know, I think, you know, I was sort of comparing the tennis angle with being a classical a pianist. You know, both of those things are very singular occupations. And I think that's what I was trying to get at, where playing in a band, playing in a loud, raucous rock and roll band, you're playing with a whole bunch of different people. You know, I think you can get in the zone doing that. And that has happened many times with me on those nights where the band just clicks, you know, where we're all playing as one. It doesn't happen, I don't think, a lot. But those nights do happen.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I can remember being in the zone on the tennis court maybe 5 times, which is...
Yeah, in 30 years, yeah.
Yeah.
I know. It doesn't happen that way. And you really know when it happens.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's almost like it reminds me of art in the sense that you keep returning to it because it's a quest for perfection.
It is, yeah. It's a very individual thing, too. You know, playing an instrument and even playing in a band is a very individual thing also.
When you sort of changed your mind about going into classical music, was that a decision that you had thought about years later? Did you struggle with that decision? And did you ever sort of, were you tempted to ever return to it when you were really playing rock and roll full time?
No, I left it behind. I was a pretty pretty decent classical player, you know. And of course, my grandmother was a classical pianist. She taught me when I was, you know, 3 years old, 4 years old, and then I went to different teachers and learned, you know, the thing. And of course, what was supposed to be the end result, I'm not even too sure, because, you know, there's only very, very few amazing virtuoso classical piano players. It's not an easy thing to achieve. I did realize that. You know, I had one major competitor, who, and of course, the idea was to go to the Royal School of Music in London and progress from there. I knew that that I was probably not going to do it, and I, of course, I was playing at that time in, you know, I was playing in a big band, a big swing band. I was playing in a blues band. I played clarinet in a traditional jazz band. I played in a rock and roll band. So I was kind of doing all those things too. And I thought, you know, I really like this. This could be good. And of course, this was the early 60s where we didn't really know what it was. You know, I mean, we didn't even have the Beatles. But I was certainly listening to, you know, American rock and roll, and I love big band music and all that. So, you know, that decision was sort of made for me in a way, and I kind of knew that I wasn't going to do it because I didn't really see a future in it. Whereas rock and roll, I thought, well, yeah, this could be good.
Yeah. So it wasn't really so much a rebellion as it was a recognition.
Yeah. No, it wasn't a rebellion at all. And, I left it behind completely. I don't have any of that. I didn't have, you know, unlike Rick and, certainly Keith, you know, they incorporated it more in their styles and their music. I didn't. I left it behind, and I became much more interested in, you know, different different forms of, well, of course, it transpired into playing the Hammond.
That's right.
Which is a completely different instrument. And the influences on Hammond were, you know, certainly a mile away from classical piano players.
But to play the Hammond, you don't use classical rudiments.
No, I didn't. I mean, I love the way that Keith incorporated into the Hammond playing. I mean, but there's only one Keith.
Right.
and he pretty much cornered that whole that whole thing. He was the only one who did it. I mean, my personal, in the Hammond thing back then was before Keith, before I'd even seen. It was a guy called Graham Bond, who was and still is unknown. Unfortunately, killed himself. But he had a band called the Graham Bond Organization with Ginger Baker, Jack Bruce, Dick Hextall Smith, and it was more of an R&B thing. But he was the first guy who turned up the growl on the Hammond. I thought, yeah, that's what it's supposed to be. Up until then, it was kind of like Jimmy Smith and Jimmy McGriff, and you know, it was more jazz players, Georgie Fame and Alan. He was the one that kind of turned me on to the turn up the Hammond and make it growl thing, which is what I tried to do in a sort of more R&B way.
As you progressed with the band and contemporary started to show up, were there guys doing what you were doing where you went, oh, that guy is pretty good? Did it? In other words, were you competitive, and were you also sort of marveling at who was showing up on the Hammond or on the keyboards?
There was only a few, you know. There was only a few people doing it, really. Keith, of course, John Lord. Rick, maybe to an extent, although he wasn't really. I mean, he was much more of a classical approach. But certainly John Lord and Keith were definitely doing what I was trying to do.
What about someone like Steve Winwood?
Yeah. So Steve was a little bit more of a mixture. I mean, I loved his playing. I mean, he was a great Hammond player, but maybe more in the style of Georgie Fame and, more jazz approach in terms of sound.
How diligent were you as a practicer? Were you the kind of guy who you would put the time in 3 or 4 hours a day, or did you sometimes let that go? Like, how were you in terms of your conscientiousness towards your practicing habits?
No, I never practiced.
Come on, is that true?
I never lived in a place that was big enough to have another Hammond in there. The Hammond was always at a rehearsal place.
So how do you maintain your chops by not being able to practice? Like, what do you do?
Well, we played all the time. You know, we played continually. I was always in a band. We started our lives in Germany, and we played clubs in Germany 10, 12 hours a day. We were constantly, you know, in those early days. My first stint in Germany, in Hamburg, was opposite the Beatles. The Silver Beatles.
Uh-huh.
They were pre-Beatles, right? And that's, you know, because we found an audience over there with, because Germany was still kind of occupied, American occupied. And there was a lot of American soldiers there, and they became our audience. And of course, we were playing American music. We had an audience. We didn't really have that audience in England, not to that extent. So these clubs in Germany, all the big towns in Germany, but specifically Hamburg and Munich and Berlin, which were occupied with thousands of American servicemen who were listening and who had records of American artists. The music we were playing, so it was the perfect learning ground.
Any interactions with the Beatles?
You know, I don't really remember. I used to go see them every night. They were in a club opposite, and of course it was pre-Ringo. George Best, and, you know, there was the three of them, and I think Klaus Voormann. I mean, it was a different band. They were the Silver Beatles then. But they were the best band on the Strip. You know, when we finished our set, we'd go watch them. And we did like 10 sets a night. I mean, we played all afternoon and all night, so...
That seems unimaginable. 10 sets a night just seems Herculean.
We never stopped playing. They just stayed open, and it was a crazy scene.
What about now? Certainly now you have a room big enough to practice a hammed organ. What is your relationship to practice now? I mean, I know you're on the road a lot, but do you find that you are diligent now, or can you, how does that work for you in terms of your practice process?
Well, actually, I mean, I'm not on the road a lot. This is this is pretty much a one-off situation, you know, because of the 50th anniversary. You know, obviously in the last few years, Billy and I have, worked on several projects, Yoso and Bill Shatner and Circa, and, you know, done a few short tours. But not a lot. So, you know, I spend a lot of time, I have a little studio set up, you know, with synths and, piano synths and my little Hammond setup, which is not a Hammond. It's, you know, a synthesized Hammond. And I do a lot of playing like that. You know, I record and play every day.
What are your... obviously 50 is an amazing milestone, but 49 was no slouch. I mean, I know we tend to sort of make big deals out of certain numbers, but, you know, 47, 48, 49 were a big deal too. But for you, what is what are your immediate sort of in the next couple of years musical ambitions? Like, what do you have in mind for musical projects for yourself?
Oh, I have none.
You have none?
No. No, I have no ambition. My passion is now, and has been for the last few years, is editing. I got into editing visual editing, and it all started with when iMovie came out, and I was fascinated because I'd always been frustrated that normal people actually couldn't do that, we didn't have the equipment to be able to do that or the facility to do that. And of course, iMovie completely changed all of that, and I just gobbled it up. It was like an amazing thing to me. Oh, I can actually take images and edit them. And so I, you know, I ran out of space on iMovie and went to Final Cut, and I'm still learning, you know, but it is a bit of a passion. I make, you know, videos and whatnot.
Do you make them for other musicians or do you make it for non-music projects?
Yeah, mainly for my wife, who is a musician and a singer. So we do quite a few videos together, a couple of times a year. We'll go on holiday, and you know, I'll film her, and we'll have a specific idea for a video, and I will film her, and then come back and, you know, make videos.
Is rock and roll by nature, because it's such a competitive, strange arena, is it difficult to maintain friendships? Have you found that, or is it easier than it seems?
I'm pretty isolated.
By choice?
Yeah, you know, I was pretty much up to maybe 56, 17 years ago. I was pretty gregarious, and you know, I was a kind of a club guy, and you know, lots of rock and roll friends and whatnot. But then I met a woman that I wanted to marry for the first time. And of course, I was relatively old at that point, and that sort of changed everything, really. It was a whole different turning point in my life, you know. I fell in love with someone for the first time, really, and got married, and that life really became, she became the center of my life. You know, in LA, we have our friends, we have mutual friends, and I have, you know, some friends from the past, and but, you know, not many. I'm pretty, you know, pretty isolated in a way. I play tennis, I edit, I play music. That's it.
That sounds like your stress level is at about zero, though. That's good.
That's something that I had to change. Yeah. It was great getting off the road, and it was great getting out of that life. It was great to get out of that competitive maelstrom of madness, and it was, yeah, stress level kind of went down.
It's a difficult thing to do. I think removing yourself from it is wise in terms of self-preservation, because sometimes if you stay in it and you stay the club guy, it's a very sort of indelicate ending if you're not careful.
Well, of course it can be, and I've seen a lot of people go down that road and implode. I was always very careful not to, you know, not to go down that road. So, yeah, it never really happened to me. It just gets to a stage where you just don't want it anymore. You know, it becomes meaningless, and something more meaningful takes over.
And when you say you're isolated, you just mean you're isolated in terms of, like, you don't hang out in the rock and roll world because you're still a gregarious guy. You have your friends, right?
Yeah, but it's much more simple. You know, and I like to go to the islands and just, you know, hang out, do nothing. And just, you know, my days are kind of easy now. Of course, I have reached an age where I'm allowed to do that. You can't be 50 forever or 40, you know. When 70 goes by, you go, oh, well, okay. You know, I feel 40, but, you know, things have changed.
Are you happier now than you've ever been?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I'm happy because I found, you know, someone that I want to be with. I was always, you know, that kind of guy on the road. I was a bit of a road dog. I never had, you know, a specific home ever. I was always kind of traveling or, you know, being somewhere else. But, you know, now, thank God, you know, at long last, I found, you know, more of a permanent existence.
Were you reluctant to go back to Yes for this 50th thing, or was it an easy thing to get you back, or did you have to think about it?
No, you know, I had to think about it, and I didn't really know. I had met a couple of years ago Steve very, very briefly one day at a hotel when I was visiting Billy. I'd been to the Greek Theater to watch the show the night before, and I went to the hotel and bumped into Steve, and I hadn't seen Steve really, although, you know, the Union tour certainly, but there were so many people in that band. And Steve, I think, was a little bit isolated on that tour. I haven't seen Steve since 1968.
Wow.
You know, so it was a little strange. Alan, of course, had been in Circa very briefly.
Right.
And I knew Jay. I'd never, ever met Jeff. So, you know, that was, and I'd never met John, the singer. So there was a few people that, you know, that were strangers. And, but of course, I went on the cruise to the Edge, and just as a kind of a tryout. And it worked beautifully, you know. So I got the offer to, to be on this tour. And of course it was 50 years. I mean, it's never going to happen again. I'm not going to, you know, there's never going to be 100 years. So, and it was great. And it was an immediate connection with all of these guys. They're all fantastic guys. And, I mean, I can't say enough about, how generous and kind, especially, you know, Jeff, because we are playing together when, you know, I don't take over from him. He's the keyboard player in Yes, and I just kind of play along, do my Hammond bit. And, it was so cool. So, you know, and it's also great to see that all the alumni, all the people that, you know, from the past, Bill and Patrick and Tom, and, you know, I'm pretty sure if Peter and Chris were still around, they would be a part of it too. You know, and it's great to see the alumni being so supportive. You know, Patrick's going to be in Philadelphia. He's going to play with the band. I mean, it's a very friendly, nice situation. If it had been, I don't know, with the other band, I don't really know. I don't talk to them, so it may not be the same. And, you know, the fact that the alumni have come over to, obviously there's competition going on between the two Yeses, ridiculous as that is. that they are being very supportive of this band is kind of a, you know, a testament to how great the people are in this band. I can't say anymore, really.
It's nice to hear that. And what do you admire about Jeff as a player?
Yeah, I said, well, we were rehearsing on, and I never really heard Jeff play before. I mean, I'd sort of admired him in Asia. Obviously, I'd heard him in Asia, and I'd heard some. I wasn't a big follower of Yes, but I'd heard some stuff that he'd done with Yes. And we were rehearsing, and one day I said, you know, you've become my favorite keyboard player because he is so good and how he interprets the players, you know, that have played in the band, how he interprets those players, yet he has his own stamp.
He's unbelievable. I actually think that if it wasn't for him, those songs in Asia were fantastic. But I mean, without him, I don't know what they would have sounded like. The guy is incredible.
No, the whole Asia thing was very much him. And he's got great technique. He's got great feel. He has a great sense of recognition of sound and how to get, you know, all the different sounds from the different eras, you know, in his setup. I mean, it's great. He's he really became my favorite keyboard player overnight.
Well, I know I have to let you go, but I got to say, I'm going to tell you, as a tennis player, I think you're a baseliner.
Up until about 5 years ago.
What happened?
Yeah. I suddenly got it. I suddenly realized what the hell you had to do. I know for a fact that professional tennis players go through the same thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Their coaches are going, go to the net. I mean, look what Nadal did. I mean, you couldn't be a more ultimate baseline dude than Nadal.
True.
But look what he's doing at the net these days.
It's unbelievable.
How many years did it take for him to do that?
Yeah, it took him 28 years. I mean, I found, you know, I played in college, and I find that I'm much better now, even though I'm older and slower, because I'm more efficient. And I think with Nadal, he's become a more efficient player because he can't stay back there at 31 and grind the way he did when he was 21.
No, he had to do it. But, not everyone can do it. Not everyone can become a great net player. It's, you know, and some of the, you know, the great doubles players, when you see what they can do at the net, you realize quite how difficult it is. I didn't like it there at all, but then you, when you figure it out on how to end the point, you know, you gotta do it.
Well, yeah, because you can get out of there in an hour instead of two.
Exactly.
Hey, Tony, what a pleasure to talk to you. I it's really a nice chat, and I appreciate your time, and congratulations on the milestone.
Great. My pleasure, Alex.
Well, there you go. Just two guys talking about tennis, life, and a band that's been around for 50 years. Tony Kaye of Yes, great chat with that guy. Do check out the Yes tour if you can. I do think that it will be worth your while. Also worth your while, checking out Bombshell Radio online. Bombshellradio.com will get you there. And if you're on iTunes, please subscribe to Bombshell Radio and subscribe to Stereo Embers, the podcast. It would mean the world to us. If you have questions, comments, or concerns, or anybody you want me to interview, please drop me a line, editor at StereoEmbersMagazine.com or on Twitter at EmbersEditor. Let's close things off with some music from Yes, and I will see you next week for another episode of Stereo Embers, the podcast.
In the morning when you rise, do you open up your eyes, see what I see? Do you see the same things every day? Of a way to start the day, getting things in proportion, spread the news and help the world go around. Have you heard of a time that will help us get it together again? Have you heard of the word that will stop us going? That will help us get it together again. Have you heard of the word that will stop us going wrong? Well, the time is near, the word you hear, when you get things in perspective, spread the news.
Hey, this is Alex Green, the host of The Heart Goes Boom, and you are listening to Bombshell Radio.
down the dreams we made. One down, one to go, another town, one more show. Downtown, give it away, but you never came back.